before I forget it as usual. Okay. Now, before we go on back in our study in 1 Samuel, I want to spend a few minutes this morning reviewing for you where we've been and some of the lives that we've talked about that affect David. We didn't start with just David's life. We started with some background information that got us there before David came on the scene. I want to start with this chart here that we've looked at before. This is kind of a chronology of the Old Testament and get us up to where we are and some of the people that came on the scene before David, and then we'll talk about David, of course, as we go along. You remember during the Old Testament history, following the Exodus, the people went in the land there under Joshua's leadership over a period of about 50 years, and Moses had allocated the land to the different tribes before they went in there, and that looked like this. Can't see all this at once, but there you see there's 12 different tribes on here. See them scattered around there like that? Now, that picture is not the United States of Israel. That's 12 different tribes under different tribal leadership, different philosophies of life, different people running things and thinking differently and that sort of deal. So how do you manage that group? How do you govern 12 different tribes all functioning differently than one another? They didn't have a central government like we have, thank God. But at any rate, God steps in and says, okay, guys, I know how to manage you. I will be your king, in effect. I'll oversee all 12 of you collectively. And he did that. He was overwatching them and taking care of them and everything. And when a problem came up in any one of the 12 different tribes, he would raise up a solution for that problem, a judge. And so there were about 12 different judges that arose in Israel during this time. And God worked through those judges. See them down there toward the end. Over a period of about 300 years, there was about a dozen of them that mounted to a whole lot. And the way the cycle normally worked is that the nation would rebel against God. They would sink back into idolatry. God would send judgment to punish them through some sort of a conquering nation that would come in and beat up on that tribe or that area. They'd cry out to God. He would turn back to them in mercy and send someone to deliver them, a judge, they were called. And there were about 12 different ones of them that cycled through that 300-year period delivering these people. So God worked to oversee and protect and take care of them through this series of judges. Like 12, as I say, and maybe one or two minor ones as well, but 12 biggies and so on. So God was taking care of them, essentially. He was their overseer. He was their king. But they weren't real happy with that arrangement. They were looking around at their neighbors who all had kings and who were leading their battles and protecting them and taking care of them and all that stuff. And they kind of wanted that for themselves. Although God had shown them that he would take care of them, they wanted a king themselves. So God raises up this last judge here toward the end of this time period by the name of Samuel. Remember Samuel's birth, how his mother could not have a child and she had a competing wife in the family there that had children and that sort of thing? Remember all that? Well, Samuel was born to Hannah, and she had offered to dedicate him to God. And so Samuel, as an infant, was taken up to Shiloh where the temple was, or the tabernacle was, and he was raised by Eli, the high priest, Samuel was. So we say, well, who cares about Samuel? Well, he's going to be the guy God will use to anoint Saul and David. So that's why Samuel is important in all of this. So he was raised in the priesthood, in effect, as a young man. and became recognized and accepted by the nation as God's spokesperson, Samuel. Unfortunately, Samuel's sons were bums. They were corrupt. And he had appointed them judges also. That wasn't his prerogative. The judgeships weren't dynastic. You didn't get to succeed your father as a judge on down the line like the kings did. So he had no right, he had no business, he had no instructions from God to appoint his sons as judges. But he did that anyway. And they were judging down in the south of Israel. And Samuel was more up in the center. And the people, the leader of those 12 tribes, knew that his sons were bums. And they didn't want his sons to continue over them. So they start making a noise, the different tribes, about wanting a king of their own, like the neighbors that they had. And they didn't really go to God and say, "You pick us a king, God." They said, "We'll pick a king." And they did. So the people pressed Samuel to anoint a king in his place to carry on things after him. Remember who that guy was? His name was Saul, wasn't it? Benjamite. Tall, dark, and handsome type guy. Very impressive, very good looking. Kind of shy at first, it seems like. But he's the guy that the people wanted. So God said, "Well, all right, I'm going to let you have this guy. I'm going to let Saul be the king that you're clamoring for." And so God had Samuel anoint Saul the first king of Israel. Remember how that came about? He's out trying to track down some donkeys. He thinks some donkeys that belonged to his father had left and strayed. And so he's out looking around for them. He runs around and bumps into Samuel at Samuel's hometown of Ramah. And it was at that encounter that Samuel anointed Saul the first king of Israel. Well, how'd he do at the start of things? Not too bad at the start, did he? Remember, there was a bad guy over on the east side of the Jordan, and he was raiding people and beating up on people and doing stuff over there, and Saul went over there and stomped on that guy and served his people quite well early on. His initial actions as the king of Israel were impressive. They were good. And that took place up here at this area called Jabesh Gilead right here. So this bad guy over here on this side was beating up on the people here, and Saul came up there and whipped up on that guy and delivered everybody, and he was looking good. Started out looking good as a king. Well, things didn't continue on quite as well as one might have hoped. God sent him on a mission down to the south of Israel to wipe out the Amalekites, that tribe that had been a problem, been a thorn in their flesh for some time. And Saul goes down there and he did some damage. He did a lot of damage, but he did not wipe out and kill the king of the Amalekites, nor did he kill all their cattle and everything like he was told to do. He kept some of that back for himself and for other people. And when Samuel confronted him about that disobedience, instead of Saul repenting, he says, "Well, wait a minute, I took care of business. I did what I was told to do." And Samuel says, "Well, how come I'm hearing all them sheep and goats and stuff in your backyard there that ain't supposed to be there? Where'd they come from?" And Samuel and Saul tried to justify his disobedience, and it didn't work out well at all. In fact, God rejected Saul as the first king of Israel. And it was signified by when Samuel turned to leave him from a meeting, Saul ripped Samuel's garment, which in effect was signifying that Saul's kingdom, his dynasty, was ripped from him. So clearly God told him early on in his kingship that his disobedience had disqualified him as God's servant, and the kingdom was going to be taken from him and given to someone else. Now, he didn't know exactly who that was at first, but he knows that it ain't going to be his kingdom, is it? So far, we haven't met David, have we? Saul's the king, but Saul's got problems. Saul is kind of like bipolar or something like that. He's kind of swinging from one end of the emotional spectrum to another, and he needed some help. He had some cockpit trouble. And so they're looking around for somebody that can help Saul deal with these psychotic fits that he's having and the way that he's swinging from one end to another. And somebody spoke up and said, well, hey, I know this guy that's a pretty good musician. A musician who can come in here and help Saul by playing some soothing, godly music for him. And they said, well, what the heck? Get that guy in here. Who was that guy?
David.
That was David. That's how David comes on the scene in Israel's history. He is a musician. He happened to also be a shepherd. His job at the time was shepherding his father's flock. And so he had a background in what we might call the arts. He's a musician. He's a shepherd, probably kind, mild-mannered guy. And so one might expect him to have been a little different personality-wise than he was, but that's what he was. So they get him and they drag David into Saul's court to try to help Saul by playing soothing, relieving music for him. So that's how he comes on the scene. So David's kind of coming in and out from Saul's headquarters back to his father's place to keep the sheep, and he's kind of going on back and forth there. He's about 17 or so at the time. One day he comes up here to see his brothers who is in Saul's army, and woe and behold, there's this big, mean, bad guy out there saying nasty things to the Israelites. He's 10 feet tall, probably weighs 500 or 600 pounds, I don't know, they didn't give his weight. Great big giant of a guy, literally a giant. His name was Goliath. He's a Philistine. And David hears this guy insulting God and insulting Saul's army, and he says, I can take this guy out. Piece of cake for me. So he offers to go out and confront this giant, Goliath, and they thought he was an idiot at first, and you know, didn't want him to do it at first, but they gradually let him and tried to fit him out with some armor and all that kind of stuff. It didn't work. So he just goes out there with an aged, old, tried and proven weapon. It's known as a sling. Basically just two pieces of cord with a patch between the two ends of them. One end is tied to the wrist and the other end's in your hand. And you sling this thing after putting a rock in it and you turn loose to the one end that you're holding and out goes the rock. And it was actually a fairly formidable weapon used by many armies for many, 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 many years. So you know the story. David goes out there and plants one right between this guy's eyes and kills him. Jumps up and gets his sword and chops his head off. Carried his head around for a week or two just to show it off. And so David becomes, instead of the musician, he becomes a military fighter, well-recognized and respected for his military activity and capability. Where'd he learn to do all that, one wonders, when he's been keeping sheep up to about the age of 17. So for the next 3 years, between about the age of 17 to 20, David is around Saul's court trying to help him out. He's actually been assigned some military duties. He's out doing those things and doing very, very well. He does so well in his military conquest, David does, at the very ripe young age of about 20, that some of the women in Israel wrote a song about him that praised him over Saul. The song said, in effect, Saul's killed his thousands, but David's killed his 10,000s. So the gist of the song is that David is the man, not Saul. David is the lead warrior in Saul's kingdom, not Saul. And everybody in Israel loved that tune, except for one guy. He didn't like it at all. Saul didn't like the fact that David was receiving the accolades of the populace, and he wasn't. He becomes very jealous. And he turns on David, tried to kill him at least 9 different times. One occasion, it was shortly after he was telling David how much he loved him and how great David was, he chucking a spear at him. But on 9 different occasions, we ought to call him David the Cat, I guess, he tried to kill David. So David concluded at about the age of 20 that he couldn't hang around Saul any longer. So he has to run and flee for his life. Now Saul had a son and they were communicating a little bit, David and Saul's son Jonathan, about what Saul was up to. And David concluded, I can't hang around here any longer. I got to get out of here. So he flees. And for the next 10 years, our young man David is running for his life in exile, hiding from Saul. 10 years. 10-year exile. Now, we've divided that up into 3 different intervals, just for management's sake. The first interval usually is referred to as the lying and deceiving years, because that's how David functioned. He didn't seek God's guidance. He just got the heck out of Dodge. Remember where he went? Where'd he go? He went to to Goliath's hometown, wearing Goliath's sword on his back. And he says, you guys mind if I hang around with you for a while here? The Philistines recognized him, knew who he was, said, what the heck is going on with this guy? So David knew he'd been recognized and found out and all, and so he pretends to be insane. He acts like he's a nutcase so that the king of Goliath's hometown, Gath, wouldn't kill him. He just run him off, and that's kind of what he did. But the whole incident seemed to be a somewhat difficult to explain decision on David's part to run down there to hide, but that's what he did. So he gets out of there with his skin okay, and he runs around for another 2 or 3 years, getting his family tucked away so that Saul couldn't get to them and kill them and all this kind of stuff. So that was like the first phase of his 10-year exile. Second phase, he kind of hung around in the Judean desert more than anywhere else. And so that's oftentimes called the Judean phase of his exile. That went on for about another 3 or 4 years. Remember the porta-potty cave that he got Saul in, could have killed him very easily if he wanted to, cut off a piece of his robe and demonstrated to Saul that he wasn't trying to kill him. He could have and didn't, even though Saul was trying to kill David. And clearly proved his case with that particular incident on another occasion. And I think kind of the third phase of all of this, he sneaks into Saul's camp, where Saul and his soldiers are sleeping, and goes up and takes a spear that's stuck in the ground right beside Saul's head and leaves. He doesn't kill him then either. And a water jug, takes them both. So he illustrated to Saul on that occasion also that he wasn't really trying to kill him. And so then he kind of gets into this third phase of his exile. And the third phase is what we've been seeing lately, and that is this sojourn down into the Philistine territory again. And he draws a conclusion about his reason to go down there that is somewhat, again, difficult to understand. He says in verse 27, David said to himself, now I will perish one day at the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than to escape to the land of the Philistines. That's not true. He has no reason to think he's going to die at the hand of Saul because God has told him he's going to be the next king. And he ain't the next king yet, so it ain't no time to die. So he makes that inexplicable decision to go down there and live with those guys to try to escape Saul's capturing of him, so on. So that the third phase is one that takes place down in the land of the Philistines, and it's somewhat odd, to say the very least, that he would do that. We've seen that in David on a couple of occasions, haven't we? We've seen him walk by sight and not by faith. Yeah, I don't know what I did with that thing. Anyway, I had a map here earlier. Well, this one's good enough. So the Philistines, remember, were over here on the left side of the map. They're on the coast over here. Here's Saul's Goliath's hometown. These cities right here are all Philistine cities along and through here. Saul never did capture all of them. That's why they're on the outside of the boundary of what he did. So, but David has come down into this area here to hang out with the Philistines to try to keep Saul away from him. He thinks Saul won't pursue him down there. So, the latter part of the exile, the 10-year exile, is about to be completed with David down there, sort of in cahoots with, sort of in partnership with, the Philistine army. So Saul and the Philistines are getting ready for another battle. Let's see if that's showing on this one. Yeah, it probably is. So what's happening is that the Philistine army now is moving up the coast here, over here in this area. They're moving up to here. And Saul and his army are moving up here. And they're kind of right around in this area here, getting ready to attack one another. You remember Saul got desperate, not knowing exactly how this thing is going to turn out, because the Philistines are looking pretty good. They got their chariots up there and all that sort of thing. So he goes and tries to consult someone to get some insight into how things are going to take place. Remember who he consulted? Yeah, a witch, or a medium, to be a little kinder perhaps. And he asks this witch to, in essence, bring up Samuel from the dead. Samuel had died by this time, so that Samuel could tell him what to do. Now, what we saw there was one of the more odd incidents in all of Scripture, because God does indeed bring Samuel back from the dead and let Samuel talk to Saul one more time. And the message that Samuel gave Saul, the last message that Samuel would give Saul, is that, Saul, you are a dead man walking. Tomorrow, not only is your army going to be defeated by the Philistines, but you and three out of your four sons are all going to die in that same battle. So all that effort to pursue what's going to take place from some satanic godless source, in his mind, turns out to be bad news for him. Now, remember, at this point in time, David is in cahoots with the Philistines. So if Saul's army and the Philistine army are about to fight one another, how is David going to not have to kill Israelites? Or he's going to have to turn on the Philistines at some point in time and fight with the Israelites against the Philistines. Unless there's something else that can happen that gets him out of that jam. And there he is, and that's what we're going to see here this morning in chapter 29. So you kind of have the background of how things have come about. The players in David's life, primary players, are Samuel and Saul. Samuel has died. Saul is going to die real soon. So that 10-year exile that David has been running around in is going to end here pretty quick. So look at chapter 29, and let's go on down the timeline now on David's life and how things are happening here. So verse 1 of chapter 29, the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek while the Israelites were camping by the spring, which is in Jezreel. That's kind of where I was showing you there a while ago. Aphek is over here on the west. See right there? Philistines are all there, and Saul's guys are over here. I don't know what that mess is across the screen there, but it didn't copyright or something. But anyway, the armies are getting together, and the lords of the Philistines were proceeding on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were proceeding on in the rear with Achish. Remember now, he's gone down to Achish and has convinced that guy that he is actually fighting Saul. Achish has embraced him, and he thinks, the king of Achish, the Philistine, thinks that David is on his side with him in this conflict. So here's all these Philistine military types, and David and his 600-man army following up from the rear, going into this battle with Israel. Then the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, who has been with me these days, or rather these years? And I have found no fault in him from the day he deserted to me to this day." Now, Achish is totally fooled by David's actions. David has been raiding other tribes and some Philistine settlements and stuff, and Achish thinks he's been raiding the Israelites. He's got this guy completely fooled. So Achish then kind of defends David's participation in this battle setup. But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Make the man go back that he may return to his place where you have assigned him, and do not let him go down to battle with us, lest in the battle he become an adversary for us. For with what could this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of these men?" In other words, they remind Achish, King Achish, "Is this not David, the one whom they sing in the dance that Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000? In other words, the other Philistine leaders, they see David in with this guy and they say, "Wait a minute, get that guy out of here. He's going to turn on us in this battle. What can he do to impress his God more than kill a bunch of Philistines here in this battle?" So the other Philistine leaders don't want David with them. Even though this guy Achish thanks David, greatest thing since sliced bread. So they say, "Get him out of here." So then Achish called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been upright, and you're going out and you're coming in with me in the army are pleasing in my sight." He doesn't know David's killing his own people, their people. He's completely fooled. "For I've not found evil in you from the day you're coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, you're not pleasing in the sight of the Lord's. So now, therefore, return and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." So here's the off-ramp for David. This gets him out of the battle. The other Philistines leaders want him sent home. Get that guy out of here. Don't let him join in this conflict. And so now the potential of him having to kill Israelites or to turn completely on the Philistines again, that's relieved by the divine providence of the other Philistine leaders saying, "Throw this guy out of here." So Achish has no choice. Verse 6, he called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been upright and you're going out and you're coming in with me in my army, pleasing in my sight." Oh, we've read that one. "Now therefore, David, return and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." And so David says to Achish, "But what have I done?" He kind of pretends that his feelings are hurt. All the good hard work that he's done for Achish, he can't complete now. He's hurt. "And what have you found in your servant from the day when I came before you to this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" He acts like he's really bummed out that he can't continue with the Philistines to fight the Philistines as enemies, his own people. He smoked this guy about as good as anything you've ever seen, didn't he? This guy has no idea that David has been attacking his own, that is, Achish's own people, not the Israelites like he thinks. And Achish answered and said to David after his mild protest there, "I know that you're pleasing in my sight like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, you must not go up with us to the battle." So that's how God gets him out of this difficult spot. Divine providence works through the other Philistine leaders to throw David out of the Philistine leader that he's hooked up with. So get up early in the morning and get out of here. Verse 10, so David rose early, he and his men, to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel. So he is relieved of duty in the Philistine army by divine providence, and it gets him out of the place where he might have to kill his own people, Israel. See what's happened there? David made an almost inexplicable decision to go live amongst the Philistines and gets into this position, kind of like Abraham and Sarah all over again, isn't it? She's my sister. Nonsense. But God gets him out of this thing through this action on the part of the Philistine leaders. Okay? A bad decision that God comes in and kind of cleans up, so to speak. Fixes on David's part, the bad decision on David's part, that God takes care of and fixes when he should have perhaps consulted him first and not gotten into this situation. Every time you see something like this happen in Scripture, we got to guard ourselves and make sure we don't jump to the conclusion that it's okay to do foolish things because God will salvage our mess that we make. Try not to make the mess in the first place is how we want to live. And so David is very fortunate here that God is with him, as we've seen repeatedly, and is taking care of him and gets him out of this mess. All right, so that's how it is that he doesn't have to kill his own people. So, then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day. Remember, Ziklag is the city that this Achish guy gave David to live in. It's down south here. See it down here? Right there? See, this guy up here gave David this city to live in with his army and so on, and it was out of this city that David was raiding all these places down south here. So, this is kind of David's interim home that the Philistine guy gave him to live in. So they return now back to kind of their home base where they were all living, him and his army and all their families and all this kind of thing. It takes 3 days to get down there. And when they get down there, they find out that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. So David's home town with his family and armies families all living there have now been destroyed by the Amalekites. And they burnt that sucker to the ground. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. Well, you remember the technique that David was using to keep from being found out is when he made raids on these cities and things. David, 27:11, David did not leave a man or a woman alive to bring to Gath, saying, lest they should tell about us. So David is wiping out all these places that he goes to, and his hometown has been wiped out by the Amalekites, but nobody's been killed. Good thing for him that the Amalekites are not using the same technique of deception that he's using, or they would have all been wiped out. Another element of divine providence, that David's family and his army's families have all been spared when he is not sparing anybody. So, when David and his men, verse 3 of 30, came to the city, And behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had all been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. Bad, bad, bad findings on the part of David and his army. And David's two wives had been taken captive. Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. His army is turning on him because they've lost their families. And they think it's David's fault. So he's now distressed. He's between a rock and a hard place too. So what's he do? What did Saul do when he was distressed? He went and found him a local witch, didn't he? Yeah, Saul turned to the demon world, the satanic world, to try to get answers and help when he was distressed. But what does David do? Verse 6. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Finally, David is coming around. Remember that inexplicable reason that he had to go down to Philistines in the first place is because Saul is going to kill him one of these days, and so there's nothing better for him to do than run to hide down there, which we know isn't true, and he should not have concluded that. He finally now turns to God for counsel. And we've seen this in him throughout his life. He will be on a high, walking by faith, and then he's on a low, walking by sight. Back on a high later, and we're seeing that cycle take place here. Here's a high. He's turning to God for instruction and information. So he turns to his on-the-staff priest, Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech. He says, please bring to me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. This guy's been here all along. Why hasn't David consulted God before? He's got a priest there on the staff. He's got this ephod with the Urim and the Thummim, you know, the dice they roll or whatever those things were, to get answers from God, to get direction from God, but he doesn't use them. He makes some crazy decision and takes off and does something before. But here he turns to God finally. So the guy brings him, and David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them? And he got the answer back from God, pursue them. You shall overtake them, and you shall surely rescue all. Now remember, when Saul turned to God for information, God would not answer Saul, because Saul was disobedient. He was unrepentant. David turns to God for answers, and he gets them. And the answers are, run these guys down. You'll not only catch them, but you'll get back everybody. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, came to the brook Bezor, where those left behind remained. Some of his men are just wasted and they can't go on any further. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 were too exhausted to cross the brook Bezor. They remained behind. So the little army of 600 is kind of broken up here now in two pieces. A couple hundred guys are just wore out and can't go any further, so they stay behind with the supplies and all that sort of stuff. And David and his 400 other guys, they keep on trucking to catch up with the Amalekites that had raided his city. So they found this Egyptian guy walking in the field, verse 11, and he brought him to David and gave him bread, and he ate, and he provided him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins, and he ate. I don't know why we have to see the menu there, but at any rate, it's there. Then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. So this Egyptian was wore completely out too, and so David and his men kind of reduced him with some food. And David said to him, well, to whom do you belong, and where are you from? And he said, well, I'm a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite. That might not have been the best thing he ever said, was it, huh? And my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites and on that which belongs to Judah and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. So this guy admits that the band that they're chasing had done the deed that David is chasing them for. So David says to him, well, will you bring me down to this band? And he says, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band. I'll take you to these guys if you promise not to harm me, the guy says. So when they brought him down, behold, they were spread all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. So this band of Amalekites had cleaned up with the spoils of war, and they had all kinds of stuff, and they're celebrating and having a big party and all that kind of thing. And David slaughtered them from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except for 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David attacks this band and wipes them out except for some kind of a little brigade of 400 guys on camels. I guess the camels were faster than the guys on foot, and they couldn't catch up with them or something, so they got away. So he did catch up with them. He did wipe them out and recovered, verse 18, recovered all the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. But nothing of theirs was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoils of anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back. He captured all the sheep, the cattle, which the people drove ahead of the other livestock, and they said, this is David's spoil. So God blessed this activity. They go catch these guys, wipe them out, and take back all the stuff that they had stolen from their various raids. So David has now got quite a cache of spoils. How many battles did David ever fight that he lost? He never lost one. Never lost a battle. So if he's on to you and he's after you, you better get out of there. Because if he catches up to you, you're going to be finished. And that's what happened to these guys. Never lost a battle. A shepherd kid. A musician, for goodness sakes. And he never lost a battle. So they come back and they meet up with the 200 guys that were resting at the brook there, and David encountered him and went out to meet David, and he met them, and they all kind of got back together. And in verse 22, some of the wicked men and worthless men among those that were with David answered and said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. So some of the fighters that went and dodged the bullets up on the front line, they said, hey, we ain't giving these guys that laid back here at the brook, these 200, we're not giving them anything. They didn't earn anything. And David said, no, guys, that ain't the right approach. You must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered us into our hand, the band that came against us. Unity was an important matter to David. He's not going to segregate his army into one camp and another camp and treat them differently. He said, who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall be his share who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike. So David's attitude, his policy was that if you're in my army, you share in the spoils and share alike, no matter what role you play. If you're bringing the food up and the other things that keeps the army going, you're going to share just as much as the guys out there on the front line dodging those bullets. So that's his attitude toward the unity of his army, and I think it probably paid dividends all of his dynastic years. So it's been that way going forward. He made it a statute and ordinance for Israel to this day. I don't know if anybody has any experience at all with the Israeli army today. Do you see that attitude still in place today? Anybody know anything about that? I assume it's still a policy they probably use. Oh, they're not out there gathering up sheep and animals anymore, are they? But whatever the spoils might be, it looks like they share and share alike. So when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. So when he gets back down here to his hometown, he shares some of this stuff that they've captured with these Judah tribes over into this area here. See Hebron right there? Ziklag is right here. So he shares things with these people right here. That'll play a role in David's kingship a little bit later on, his sharing of the spoils with the Judahites. And he names off some of the cities there. Those are all just Judean cities in 27 and 28 and 29 and 30. And to those who were in Hebron and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. Hebron was sort of a home away from home for him. So all of these Judah tribe people there in that region have now benefited from David's leadership, from his military activity, and from the spoils that he's taken here for them. Remember that in a little while, and we'll talk about why that matters when we go on a little further. Let's stop here and save this last chapter for next week, and then we can go on from there if we need to. We'll talk about Saul and his life a little more next week than we got time left to do here today. The 10-year exile of David is about to come to a conclusion, and we'll look at the detail of that next week. So any questions about what we've seen so far now in this man's life? He's about 30 now. The exile took about 10 years. So he went from a 17-year-old shepherd boy who could play music and who was real handy with a sling to a esteemed military leader of Israel, fleeing the first king of Israel for a period of about 10 years, but making some friends, scoring some points with people as he went and as he functioned as a leader of his little band of 600 or so guys. He still ain't on the throne, is he? But he's going to be real soon. He'll be on there next week. But he's not the king yet. He has refused to depose Saul himself. He had opportunity. And it looks like as good a soldier as he was, he could have done it any time he wanted to. But he has refused to do that. He has allowed God to take care of things. If Saul had had any kind of sanity about him at all, he would have abdicated as soon as he knew that the kingdom had been torn from him and become part of the replacement and had probably an illustrious and successful life. But he refused. He opposed God the whole time. He tried to kill God's appointed guy. The next guy in line, Saul tried to kill. And we'll see how that works out for him next week. But he could have had a admirable and impressive end as the first king of Israel. We'll see if that works out next week also. Questions or comments about anything?
What I see is David, he was a fair king. You know, he shared spoils with different people, his enemies.
No, not with his enemies.
He shared the battles.
He didn't share his spoils with his enemies. He shared them with his friends and the people in Judah.
Oh, with the people in Judah. Okay.
So he took them from other people, but he shared it with his own people.
So David was, that's why he was a man after God's own heart, because although he was human, his human part played into that too with the sins that he committed. But he was still a man after God's own heart. I mean, he still sought the Lord in things that needed to be done.
I think his reverence, his esteem for the things of God was so high. Like you say, he refused to kill Saul, tried to kill him at least 9 different times. He refused to kill him when he had multiple opportunities because he would not put his hand on God's anointed. He said, God, you take him out when you're ready. I'm going to wait here on the sidelines, and when you're ready and you get him out of the way, I'll step into that role. But he would not usurp God's anointed in that role at all. And I think that's part of that statement. That he's a man after God's own heart is he revered the things of God. He esteemed the things of God. Saul clearly did not. Saul revered Saul.
And the word of God showed us that he was human just like us with that sin in his life, although he sought God and trusted God.
If he'd stepped aside earlier on and partnered with his protege, his next in line God. Could have been a great and wonderful life for him, but he did not. He battled God and refused to step aside the whole way until God stepped him aside. Yes, ma'am.
But this 10-year period was really kind of a teaching and maturing period for David.
Yeah, it's prep time.
You know.
And Moses only needed 80 years to get ready. Makes you wonder what the heck was wrong with Moses.
I never felt like an adult until I was 30.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you still have got all those hormones and
yeah.
Everything going on.
He clearly at age 20 was not ready to assume the throne. At age 30, he is more ready.
Right.
But even now, he's not going to assume at all.
Right.
He steps another step toward that, and he's like 37 by the time he gets the whole kingdom. So he needed some prep time, and God does that with this, doesn't he? He prepares us for whatever role he calls us for, and in David's case, he was dodging spears for a while and other things like that to get ready. So one can always wonder, well, what's the real benefit of this? What's he learning here and so on? But clearly God knows, and whatever he went through, it was because God wanted him to go through that, and he will be ready when the call is made here pretty quick. Any other questions, comments about this guy? Very, very interesting character, isn't he? Saul was a very pathetic character, very pitiful. The three most pitiful lives I think you could study in Scripture is Judas, Saul, and Samson. Those are the three most tragic lives in Scripture, with Judas being number one. He rubs elbows with the Lord with the Son of God for 3 years, hears all the stories, all of the presentations that the Lord makes, sees all the miracles that he does and all that stuff, and dies in unbelief and kills himself. That's tragic. Saul ain't a whole lot better. And Samson was just a kid. He never could grow out of being a kid. And so he could have served the Lord in great capacity, and yet he ends up killing himself too. Judas, Saul, Samson, all three killed themselves. All three lives in a tragic way through suicide. We out of here? I guess we are. All right, we'll see you next week, Lord willing. Probably we'll be back in the other room. Look for us there.